From the Independent Producer Project and KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional.
Best of five goals.
Unfictional is a program of stories, personal documentaries, and radio movies. And on this episode, Father's Day 2017. My son Matthew and I invented this game called Living Room Soccer. It's played just like regular soccer, except in our living room, with an inflatable ball. 1 point per goal, plus in our game, you lose a point if you accidentally hit the dog or Matthew's 13-year-old sister, Tess.
Okay, 2-0. You need to score 3 goals here if you want to win. 3 goals in a row.
The goal sizes were originally established 3 years ago when Matthew was in kindergarten. So I'm defending a large doorway, and Matthew's goal is a narrow opening between the couch and a bookshelf.
Finally, I got one.
What? Okay.
That was in there.
Well, for my view, it looked like a post.
It glanced in off the post.
No, it didn't.
Expect some changes to the rule book of living room soccer.
Mario Kart 8 Deluxe.
Right now, Matthew's focus is on the new Nintendo system and the games he hopes to get for his birthday.
Fire Emblem Warriors, I think that's what it was called.
We'll see about that. But in just a few weeks, he'll be heading off to YMCA summer camp. He went last year when he was 8, and it seemed really young for him to be away for a week. But he went with one of his best friends, Sam.
All of the activities are the same, like riding horses, ziplining. I'm thinking of some awesome ones.
Yeah. And did you do horses last time?
Yeah, we rode on horses. His name was Harry, and he liked Candy, the one Sam was riding, but Candy hated him.
Yeah.
So he just kept going to Candy and making these weird sounds, and then Candy would try to kick him. And me and Sam were on those horses when that happened.
My wife and I learned something this year about 9-year-olds, boys in particular. Apparently, it's an important age for the slow human development of self-awareness that started for Matthew when he was born. In Matthew's early years, real life and stories and his inner thoughts all blended together. It was like a dream world. Around 5 years old, he realized he was his own man. He could imitate everybody and be a part of things.
How do you say hello and goodbye in Hawaiian?
Aloha. It's Hawaii.
But it's at 9 years old that a kid realizes, hey, wait a minute, I'm really my own thing. I'm an independent entity floating free in the universe. Now, I'm not saying Matthew did any of these things, but sometimes honest boys will start lying. Lots of new questions get asked. Nightmares, headaches, a confused rage. You get the sense that it's the enormity of what it means to be a human just starting to sink in for a kid. And then just as quick, he's happy to be a kid again.
So you're looking forward to it?
Yeah.
I'm good. I think it's so cool. I think you're so
cool. I got a little homesick last time because my cabin mates were like the loudest people in the world. I got homesick on Tuesday because I thought it was way farther in the week than it actually was. Oh. That just made me feel bad because I like missed you guys.
Oh. When we picked you up, you were all tan and you had all your like wristbands.
I had tan?
Yeah, well, because you'd been doing so many outside activities. I remember you seeming very grown up when I saw you.
It's a good thing that we don't kick our children out of the nest too early. It takes years. We just move away really slowly as he hits these points of his life where he needs some space to operate and figure out what he's capable of.
Uh-oh.
I won!
Good game.
This week on Unfictional, Father's Day 2017. 3 stories of fathers and their children. Next, the story of one father who seemed to change over the years, from a militant young anti-war activist to a more moderate guy, or even, if you ask his children, a conservative. From KCRW, it's Unfictional.
My name is Mark Mordecai Green. This is my dad. He's a retired university professor. He's got one of those old-timey Brooklyn accents. It comes out in full force when he's feeling vehement.
I felt like giving the finger to authority.
There are lots of things my dad and I disagree on, like whether it's safe to hitchhike in a foreign country, or how many layers of clothing to wear in a New York City snowstorm. But the thing we disagree about most often, most reliably, is politics.
I'm idealistic, but I'm also realistic.
Usually people say that those are opposites.
Not in my life. I have idealistic feelings, but I also realize the limits of change.
I realize that the older we get, the further we move away from each other politically. But I've also come to realize that maybe we wouldn't disagree quite so much if I'd known my dad at a different point in his life, when he was closer to my age. I wasn't born yet, but I know about it because of the stories my dad tells. And there's one in particular that he's told so many times that's so central to the story of his life that I knew it by heart before I ever understood what it really meant. Before I knew how my dad fit together with a very different sounding man I'd heard about in those stories. Back in the 1960s, my dad was a chemistry professor at the University of Michigan. He was a rising star in his field, but also a complicated guy.
I remember going down to the basement of the house that we bought and just killing flies left and right in a rage. I was not happy.
He was going to town on the flies in his basement because even though he was a successful young academic, he was also in a really unhappy marriage. He was married to the mother of my two half-sisters, Lisa and Emily. Eventually, they separated, but the anger and the unhappiness, it lingered. One thing you need to know about my dad is that he's always been kind of eccentric, even for a lifelong chemistry university professor. He's always done things his own way. Like when, on top of his full-time professor work, he started a bakery.
And there was a farmer's market in Ann Arbor, and Charlie Overberger, who I knew well, he was the chairman of the department. Charlie comes by with a couple of very fancy European visitors, you know, like big deal professors. And there I was behind a counter selling bread that I'd baked, you know. And he introduced me. Professor so-and-so, this is Professor Green, who teaches chemistry. And they said, oh, hi, nice to meet you, and stuff like that.
Were you embarrassed?
No. I was making atomic muffins.
After the separation, though, my dad's unhappiness started morphing and twisting the eccentricity. He'd have outbursts. He started taking karate classes for no reason in particular.
Maybe I thought the world was falling apart and I wanted to be able to protect myself or something.
Still, my dad's unhappiness never affected his work. He loved his research, his lab, his students. But then...
My fellow Americans, air action is now in execution against gunboats and certain supporting facilities in North Vietnam.
My dad says the Vietnam War sent him over the edge.
I acted out a lot of the stuff that I was feeling on my protest to that war.
My dad believes that war is immoral and unjustified in most cases, including maybe even especially in Vietnam. And then the Quakers got a hold of him.
So the Quakers got a hold of you.
Quakers got a hold of me.
Quakers are pacifist Christians, call themselves the Religious Society of Friends. And during the Vietnam War, Quakers were a major part of the resistance. They organized protests against the war, peaceful ones, obviously. They helped out conscientious objectors. They even sent aid to Vietnam. A group of Quaker activists heard my dad was an anti-war professor at Michigan, and they got a hold of him. And they gave him some slides about weapons that were being used in Vietnam. Weapons that were banned under the Geneva Convention, my dad says.
We were doing illegal things there.
All of a sudden, my dad's unhappiness about his marriage and about the war, it found a useful outlet. But it also meant that the three lightning rods of my dad's life, his work, his anti-war activism, and his anger issues, they all converged. He decided to show the slides to his students. And he says he wasn't really thinking about what the consequences might be. In a school newspaper article, my dad said he wanted his students to know that what they were learning in his class was being used by big corporations to make the weapons in the slides.
Those weapons are beautiful demonstrations of explosions in chemistry, which have to do with fundamental intermediates in chemistry.
He got up in front of his students with those slides, and he turned it into a chemistry lesson.
An explosion is a chemical reaction that occurs by a chain mechanism. A chain mechanism is a mechanism in which an exothermic chemical reaction, that is a chemical reaction that gives off heat, where the heat that the reaction gives off then causes more molecules to undergo that reaction. And so you get a chain. The heat feeds back, makes more heat, and everything goes faster and faster. You get an explosion.
His students ate it up. They were just as infuriated by the slides as he was.
You know, you can imagine they were like you, you know. Well, even younger.
The lecture happened on a Thursday. 4 days later, on Monday, October 9th, 1972, he was suspended. 200 students marched on the chairman's office demanding my dad be reinstated. Didn't work. Not long after, my dad was essentially fired. He was denied tenure. And getting denied tenure at Michigan actually really messed things up for my dad professionally. He kept working as an academic. He went to India on a Fulbright at one point. But for a while afterwards, he had a really hard time getting a stable tenured position. He got blacklisted in the academic world, he says. But my dad also says it all could have been avoided.
I think I still would have done this, but I would have done it in a way that would not have put off my colleagues so much. You know, like being combative and argumentative instead of persuasive. I think I could have been a more friendly protester.
In the end, after years of chasing professorships around the country, my dad ended up landing one, a tenured position, in New York City. And that's where he stayed for decades, until he retired this year. New York is where he met my mom and where my brother and I were born. Despite what happened at Michigan, my dad went on to have a long and successful career as an organic chemist.
Do you feel proud about what you did?
Yeah, I don't feel bad about what I did at all. I think the accumulated activities of a lot of people like me in the late 60s and early 70s is what ended that war.
I feel good about what he did, too. I'm proud of him. Here's the thing. In the years since Michigan, my dad has mellowed out a lot. He's not angry the way he used to be. But as he's mellowed, he's also gotten more conservative, politically. Well, I say conservative.
Even though you kids think I'm a total right-winger, I'm not that bad, actually.
Here is what my dad says he believes about the world.
In my opinion, my years of living and from what I've seen, you're not going to change the world. You might do a little good here, a little good there, but the best thing is to take care of yourself in a way that doesn't hurt others, that doesn't hurt the world, but take care of yourself and put yourself in a place where you can be safe from the craziness.
I totally, totally disagree. Thanks in large part to my dad, I grew up privileged. I personally have benefited from the unequal way our society is set up. And I think that means I have a responsibility to try to help fix it. My brother Frank feels the same way.
The political views that Frank and I have, do we remind you of yourself at all?
Yeah, I think so.
So do you think we'll get over it?
No, I don't think you'll ever get over the feelings that you have about what's right and what's wrong. But I think you will become wiser about what's possible.
I hate hearing that, because what I hear isn't what my dad is trying to tell me, that with age and experience come wisdom. What I hear is this. My dad has given up on the things he used to believe, and so will I. Maybe he's less militant because he's mellowed out, because he's happier and less angry than he used to be. Or maybe that's just what happens as you get older. But it's hard not to feel like, if that's what happened to my dad, it's what'll happen to me, too. Still, that doesn't mean I've stopped trying to change his mind about this stuff. I first interviewed him back in May 2016. And then, a couple months later...
Sorry to keep you waiting. Complicated business. Complicated.
I thought maybe, Trump would be enough to rattle my dad's political convictions.
Thank you very much.
Force him to admit that keeping yourself safe couldn't really be all that matters. So, I called him up.
Carla? Why are you calling me on this strange no-caller ID unknown telephone?
I'm calling you from Skype.
What?
My dad says Trump's election surprised him, scared him.
I don't know what to do, you know, about it. I mean, I really object to him very strongly, but I just don't know what to do.
At first, he said he wouldn't go out and protest. But when I pressed him, he wobbled.
I mean, if Trump followed along a path dark enough that I saw such an extreme danger to the country and to the people, I might actually do something like that.
Do something like get out and protest, he means. But then, just a few weeks later, when I talked to him again...
Even when I said I might protest, it was a long shot. I mean, really, I don't want to do that. I don't know what I want to do, but I don't think that these protests have much use.
But the thing is, I don't actually fully believe that he believes what he's saying. Because just a couple years ago, my dad did something that showed he's much more like the young Michigan professor version of himself than he likes to admit. My dad's a professor, and at the end of almost every year, up until he retired last year, he would put on his professorial robes and sit on the stage to watch his students graduate. But a couple years ago, in 2007, something was different. An admiral under George Bush, his vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was the speaker. My dad stood up. He gave a speech about why he couldn't support, even tacitly, a man who'd been central to the war in Iraq. And then he walked off stage in protest.
I had to say something, and I got an applause, too.
I was in high school at the time, and I was totally embarrassed. Back then, I couldn't imagine anything worse than being like my dad when I grew up. Now, I'm embarrassed that I was embarrassed of my dad having political beliefs. I'm proud of him for walking off stage. Obviously, I've changed a lot since I was a teenager. But there's some things about me that haven't changed. Like, as my dad will tell you, how I never give him a break. There's a thing he likes to say whenever I give him a hard time. I'm only a dad. He says it just like that. Carla, I'm only a dad. Like the fact that he's my dad means I should cut him some slack. No way. I'll never let him off the hook. He's my dad. I love him too much.
That story was produced by Unfictional associate producer Carla Green, with editing and sound design by me, Bob Carlson. You're listening to Unfictional on KCRW. And I invite you to subscribe to the Unfictional podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like the show, leave us a nice review. It helps other people find the program. On this episode, Father's Day 2017. And if you've listened to this program for a while, you know I'm kind of a sucker for father stories. I'm a father myself. I had a great dad. And there have been a lot of good father stories on this program. So we'll close with one of my favorites from a past live episode. It's a story from writer-director Mike White about how his dad's advice ended up landing him in a mental hospital and then, in a roundabout sort of way, came to save him. From KCRW, it's Unfictional.
Okay, so I had a nervous breakdown. It was like a few years ago, and I was running a show I created for Fox called Cracking Up, weirdly. And I it was like, you know, they hated what I was doing, and the whole thing was like super stressful, and there was a lot of rage and like pain and like so I woke up in the middle of the night one night, and I was like, oh yeah, I'm so pissed, and I like wrote this email. It was like, you lied to me. This is to the head of the network. You lied to me. You don't know what you're doing. You know, like, you ruined the show. And then I CC'd, like, every bigwig I could think of, and then I sent it. And I guess I think I was hoping that they would fire me, but then, like, the next day, I got a call, and they was like, the president of the network is in her office, and she's crying. She's never felt so devastated by a writer. And I was like, well, that wasn't really what I was going for, but I... And then they were like, and where's the next script? And I started having like a panic attack. So I called my dad, because my dad is like the expert of therapists in Southern California, because he spent his whole life in therapy. Basically the backstory is that he was raised by his evangelical missionary parents to be like the next Billy Graham. And he came close. He like wrote books for Billy Graham and Jerry Falwell. He was like in the evangelical elite. There is one. And he had his own ministry and a perfect wife and kids and da 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 da. But he was gay. So So he spent most of his adult life trying to, like, get the gay out, like electroshock therapy and all these different kinds of therapies to just not be gay. And then when he realized that he couldn't do that anymore, he told his evangelical parents that he was gay, and they said they wished he drowned in the pool. So he spent the next couple years, like, or the, you know, I mean, still to this day, going to therapists to, like, I don't know, get over the shame and pain and whatever, all that. So I was like, he would know a good person to talk to. So I called him, and he was like, I have the perfect person, Warren Jones in Pasadena. So I go to this guy in Pasadena, and the guy's like, do you ever have suicidal thoughts? I was like, well, I want to throw myself in front of buses, but that's not, like, new. It's like, and so he was like, well, you can't go to work. You need to go somewhere where you can, you know, just relax. And that sounded good. And I was like, yeah, I don't want to go to work. In my mind, I was thinking it was like the Four Seasons with, like, a burger and sedatives and, like, you know, Real Housewives. And next thing I know, I'm being checked into a mental institution where people are, like, you know, like, walking through the halls, like, really medicated. And I was like, you know, I'm stressed. I'm not, like, crazy. And they were like, you're here now, just get the help you need. And I was like, no. And so I ran out of the mental institution and got in my car and started driving as fast as I could. And then I looked at my phone and I realized there were like 12 messages. And I checked the phone and it was all these executives and producers who'd like made my life a living hell. And they were like weeping on the phone, don't worry about the show, just get the help you need. Because this psychiatrist that my dad had recommended had called my the office and said, Mike is going to a mental institution to get the help he needs. And I was driving on my way back to work. And then my dad called and he was like, how did it go with Jones? I was like, it didn't go good, Dad. It didn't go good. So the show was canceled and that was fine. And, you know, but it was one of those moments where I was sort of like, what's wrong with me that I could, you know, let a Fox sitcom get me that unraveled? And it's like, I need to do something different. I can't just like pour myself back into work because that's what I'd been doing my whole life. And I was like, I gotta do something different. I'll go on The Amazing Race, right? Because, like, that's what you do, right? Because, but in my mind, it seemed right. It was like, you know, you get out of LA, you do something, you don't take yourself so seriously. I don't know. In my mind, I was like, this is gonna be the solution for me. So I made a tape, and I actually was accepted, and we were down to, like, the finals or whatever. I was going with another screenwriter, and we were going as, like, these neurotic screenwriters who never left the house. And in my case, it was kind of like just a, you know, that was my, like, the gimmick, but it turned out it was not the gimmick for him. You have to take a psych test and meet with a therapist, and he completely failed. And he was like, you know, they were like, you score off the charts with anxiety. And he's like, I know, I'm afraid of heights and planes, and I'm afraid my bowel movements won't be regular. And I'm afraid that I won't, you know, when we get eliminated, we don't get to go home. We have to go to this elimination station, which is not like a prison. It's like a resort in, like, Thailand or something. And I'm like, John, we're not going to get eliminated. We're going to win. And he looks at me in front of the therapist. He's like, do you realize how crazy you sound right now? Anyway, that didn't work. And I was starting to feel like, I was like, I can't get through these, like, therapist gatekeepers. Like, this is really frustrating. And so, but I was like, I really got to go to The Amazing Race. And so the casting people were nice enough that they came to a party of mine and they scoped it out to see who would be the right person for me to go to The Amazing Race. And at the end, they were like, you got to go with your dad. And I was like, that's not really the vibe I was going for here. Like, I want to do something light. My dad's almost 70, but I was so desperate. I felt like this was my last chance. I was like, and my dad was gung-ho. So I was like, okay, we'll do it. And they pushed us through to the front. And, you know, like, we didn't have to do anything. All we had to do was take the psych test and meet with the therapist. And so we go down there, and I'm already looking at my dad, and he's looking at the bubbles, and he's, like, really taking his time. I'm like, Dad, this is just a rubber stamp, so we can go, you know, we're not trying to get free therapy here, okay? And he's like, And so we go in, and we sit with the therapist, and the therapist is like, I'm sorry to tell you, but Mel, that's my dad, you failed the test. And I was like, how is this possible? Like, if you've seen reality shows, like, they're all crazy. Like, how can I not know anybody who can pass one of these psych tests? I don't understand. And they were like, you know, I was like, what is wrong with him? And they were like, you know, he just scores off the charts as paranoid, like super paranoid. And what had happened is that my dad, after he came out, he decided to become a gay activist when he was trying to fight some of this religion-based sort of negative stuff about gays, because in a way he was trying to get his parents to love him, and he was trying to get the whole evangelical community to change their mind about, and they're not going to change their mind. And it's like, and so, but he would go to the front lines of all of these places, and people would spit on him, and, you know, death threat. I mean, it was like, yeah, I mean, so over the years, it had made him, yeah, he was paranoid. He was like, so he said, yeah, well, people are trying to kill me. I mean, I get death threats all the time. And the therapist was like, okay, well, then you said you have visions. He's like, well, once I was imprisoned for my activism and I was stuck in a jail for 2 weeks and I went on a hunger strike. And after 2 weeks, I saw my heroes in the cell with me, Mohandas Gandhi and Martin Luther King. I mean, I know they weren't there, but it was like they were there. You know what I mean? And I'm sitting there like, Dad, what are you doing? And he's like, well, what about Mike? What does the test say about Mike? And it's like, well, it says he's, you know, well-adjusted. I mean, and he's like, he's lying. He's just trying to make him look better for the test. He had a nervous breakdown. So she pushed us through. We got on. But then, and so, and actually we, you know, the race was fun. We actually did pretty well. We got through like 7 legs of the race. And then what was so amazing was that then when it started airing, all these people not only recognized my dad, but they would like stop and they'd be like, you know, you are so sweet. You're so sweet. Your son, like, we love you. And it was, and like my dad, this was the catharsis he had waited his whole like life for. Like, for people to see him as this great dad and this funny guy. And it was weird. It was like he, and after we got eliminated, like a million people stopped watching the show. And I was like, Dad, those are like Billy Graham numbers, you know? So I guess the point of the story is that next time you're going through some kind of psychological crisis or, you know, some you know, midlife breakdown, maybe instead of therapy, you should go on a reality show. Because it helped us. So anyway, thank you.
Mike White is an acclaimed actor, writer, and director living in Los Angeles. That story was told live at the Riot LA Comedy Festival in 2014. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The editor is Nick White. The associate producer is Carla Green. I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.